Hello, friends. It's nice to be here. It's nice to be back. And it was lovely to sit with you. And I appreciated how David opened the sit, this invitation into the profound simplicity of being with moment by moment experience. Pointing us to that core teaching of impermanence, this river of ever-changing, unfolding reality. And one of the things that I have found fascinating over time is that it often seems like there's this one tiny little piece of real estate that's exempt from this truth of impermanence. Like many of us who have practiced for a while might say, oh yeah, I get it. Things are changing. I see the river. I believe it. But it's kind of like we're standing in the middle of the river on this little tiny island. It's like this little rock, and we're watching things flow by, and here's this exemption of the self. Like somehow we don't see that we are actually standing in the middle of the river of change, which gets us into some trouble. And it's the source of often a lot of suffering. So I thought it would be fun to play with this tonight and explore. And over the years, when I have tried to explore this question of, oh, what is the self? From here, it often becomes this real tangle. I can almost feel the knot right here between the eyebrows. It's like the organ that is so good at manufacturing a self, framing it and hanging it on the wall, cannot comprehend that question of, like, what's the self? It's like, huh? It's kind of confused. And so, and what I've found over the years is that it's easy to get tangled in sort of a philosophical exploration of what is the self. And what I've become really interested in over the years is how to play with this in a very embodied, practical way. Like, how might we start to explore this experience of selfing as a process, as part of the river, and to do it in daily life. And so that's where I want us to go tonight, to try to share with you some of some very practical, simple, not often easy, but simple ways in daily life of unpacking this question of, what is the self? And to explore how to take the self less seriously. Sometimes we take ourselves so seriously, don't we? And one of the frameworks that I want to begin with is a teaching called the Five Aggregates. Some of you may have familiarity with this. Some of you may have never heard of it before, and that's fine. And to acknowledge right up front that often there, like, a whole talk is dedicated to unpacking what are these aggregates. And what I actually want to do is to present them relatively briefly in comparison and then take a really deep dive into a couple of real-life examples of where these aggregates show up and how we might recognize them and work with them. So as I'm sharing this, it's kind of so we have a framework in which, like an umbrella, under which to sit and view these particular examples. And so it's not about whether you encode all of these, like, you know, concepts or words or ideas. It's just giving us some reference points. And so let's look at these aggregates. This is a teaching that is nested in a number of places. One of them is the Satipatthana Sutta. Some of you are familiar with those four foundations of mindfulness. It's like this incredible roadmap for practice. And the five aggregates is nested in the fourth foundation, which is, you know, this mindfulness of mind objects or of dharma. It's got companions in there with things like the five hindrances, the seven factors of awakening, you know, good stuff. And the aggregates are part of this map. And it's a funny word, isn't it? Aggregate. Sort of, you know, in Webster's dictionary, I was looking up, I love the dictionary. Those of you who have been to talks before know I love reading the dictionary. And it's described as, one definition is, formed by the collection of units or particles into a body mass or amount. You know, it's sort of this bringing together. I think of concrete, you know, you think of like concrete sidewalk with all these pebbles in it. It's like this aggregate of all these little pieces that are sort of hanging together. And it's sort of a weird choice in some ways. In some of the other translations, the Pali word, that ancient language of the Buddha, the Pali word is skanda, and it's other translations are bundle, or pile, or heap. And my favorite translation from one of my teachers is the five kinds of stuff. The five kinds of stuff that make up a moment of experience. And so I want to introduce you to the five kinds of stuff. And one of the things I really love about the five aggregates is that it actually offers a very practical, experiential way of looking at self. You may not believe that yet from the title, but we're going to play with this. And that it's not conceptual. When I first met them, they felt kind of conceptual, but my hope is that by the end of tonight, you might have some connection with these. So the first one is known as form. Form, the Pali word is rupa, and there's different ways of describing form. I like Guy Armstrong's description. This comes from his book on emptiness, and he talks about how form is the body, but it's not just like the body here, you know, this physical form that's sitting in your chair. It can also be thought of as the five physical senses, you know, so hearing, smelling, tasting, seeing, sensing, and also what's out there. So form isn't just, you know, a lot of times the Buddha teaches about inner and outer. That shows up in lots of places. And so he also says it's the five, forms of sense objects. So it's also sight, sounds, taste, smells, sensations. So it's really the physical. The form is the physical part of a moment or experience. And then we have these four mental ingredients or kinds of stuff that show up in a moment. The second one is feeling tone. You may have heard that word sometimes, vedana. And this is the flavor of experience. You often hear it described as pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Usually the shorthand for that is neutral. So pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And one of the things about this flavor of experiences is it's actually a movement of the heart in response to what's arising in experience. It's not inherent in the object. We usually project it onto the object, you know. So we might hear this bell. Oh, pleasant. But actually, pleasant doesn't live in the sound of this bell. You may be sitting next to somebody who's going unpleasant, you know, or sort of neutral. So it's this movement of the heart in response to what's arising in one of the six sense gates. So there's the five physical senses in the physical realm, but there's also this added sixth sense that shows up as a part of experience that these four other aggregates respond to, and that's the mind, the activity of the mind. So we have form, we have feeling tone. The third aggregate is perception, and that's the Pali word sanya. And perception's an interesting one. Perception is the conceptual naming, labeling, categorizing. It's sort of like going through the Rolodex of the mind to identify a moment of experience. You know, I was sitting in meditation a few days ago, and a sound came into awareness. And all of a sudden, what popped into the mind was this image of a V of geese flying through the sky. Geese honking, that, you know, and it's lightning quick. Perception is not like I am, you know, sifting through the Rolodex and like a minute later, or, you know, it's like milliseconds, and we have put a label on something. And we think, and this is not a neutral process. This is really influenced by our experience, our history, our expectations in a moment, our biases. You know, so perception's often inaccurate, but we don't notice that because it's like wrong, but not completely wrong. So we don't see the distortions most of the time. Occasionally, there's an example that's really clear where it's wrong. I was reflecting back years ago, I was on a retreat, and there was this sweet little bench in the woods, and I was meditating, and so peaceful. And I was just listening to the breeze and the trees and, you know, deep in this, ironically, you'll see where this goes, in the, you know, it was a heart meditation, and I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden there's all this, like, crunching of leaves and you know, noise behind me, like, right behind me, and I'm like, irritation flares up, and I'm like, can't they see I'm sitting here having this really deeply peaceful meditation? Who is this, you know, that is just barging into my peaceful forest? And I got so irritated that I opened my eyes and I like turned around, and you know, like about 12 feet from me is this like beautiful coyote staring me in the face. My entire construction of that moment fell away. Perception was dead wrong? You know, I'm thinking this is a really insensitive yogi. And all of a sudden, it's like this moment of natural wonder, right? So perception is tricky. And it influences experience. The fourth aggregate, another fancy term, it's called volitional formations and or sankharas. And this is a big basket. This includes a lot. And for tonight, we'll just sort of acknowledge that it includes thoughts, emotions, moods. It's really, you know, mind states. It's kind of almost like everything else that's not form or feeling, tone, or perception. So it's all that activity of the mind. And as we'll see when we're unpacking examples, it's often the place that's where we get into the most trouble. And then the fifth aggregate is consciousness, vijnana, and it's really this bare knowing. It's actually what illuminates an experience at one of the six sense gates. So we have these five kinds of stuff, these five elements that come together to make a moment or a sense of self. And there's a lot more that could be said about all of this, but I just want to give us a framework and so that we can start to explore, you know, how experience arises and how that impacts how we move through the world. And one of the playful ways I like to think of this, you know, if you want to really sort of have a different way of looking at this. I'm a huge fan of Harry Potter. And for those of you who don't know, in the world of Harry Potter, and if you don't know, I highly recommend. It's just a lovely world to explore. But in Harry Potter, there are wizards and there are muggles. Muggles are non-magical humans. And so there's this scene in book one. So Ron Weasley is this wizard, and he comes from a wizarding family. And he's got a classmate, Seamus, who comes from a muggle family. So you can be a wizard born into a muggle family. And, you know, they're in their dorm room, they're unpacking, they're decorating, and Seamus, this muggle, hangs up a photo of his favorite soccer team. And Ron looks at it, and he thinks, this is crazy. Like, he can't believe that nobody's moving in this muggle photo that's hung on the wall. And, you know, because in wizard photos, everybody moves. You know, they visit other photos, they, you know, they have parties, all kinds of things happen. So this is actually kind of akin to what happens with this process of the aggregates coming together. It's like this moment of freeze frame where all of a sudden we think we are living in a muggle photo. You know, that the self is something solid, consistent, unchanging, and we can put a frame around me, hang me on the wall, and that's what I'm going to be like. And the truth is, we're actually living in a wizard photo. And things are moving and changing all the time, all the time. So if you want a more playful, simplified version of the aggregates, you can just think about wizard and muggle photographs. You know, it's one of my shorthands for the aggregates over the years. So I want to look at an example. And I think this is an example that we can all relate to. And this particular version of this example occurred on a retreat. So I will acknowledge that retreat is really helpful because it It's like the volume gets turned down on all the distractions. The mind slows down enough that we can watch things in greater detail. And we can really learn something about the habits of mind. But this example is so relatable, and I really do believe, and I have seen it to be true in my own practice over the years, that we can do this out in daily life, not in the same refinement, but I want us all to benefit from this slow motion unfolding of an example of the aggregates just coming to life. So on this retreat, I had a roommate who snored. Some of you may be able to relate to this experience. Some of you may have a roommate who snores that you go home to every night. You know, so this is part of human experience. So I loved to sit the last sit of the night. And my roommate is an early bird, likes to go to bed early. So I come back from the last sit of the night, the room is dark, I open the door, and I'm greeted with this sound in the corner, her side of the room, which is not very far from my side of the room. And, you know, get ready for bed, get into bed, and there I am, lying there, and you know, I'll acknowledge, this is maybe like day three of the retreat, so I'm a little more settled, and I sort of see the unfolding more clearly than on nights one and two. So you're getting the benefit of a little bit of clarity. And, you know, here come the aggregates. Form. One way to think about form arising, right? We said it's like the five sense gates and sense objects. So here's an ear object, a sound. Here's an ear that receives the ear object. Here's ear consciousness, this awareness at the sense gate. All three of those things come together, and there is a moment of sense contact. There is form. And perception. Perception and feeling. I find in practical experience, it's really hard to tell who shows up first. I often find they tag team, you know, or they show up together holding hands. Like experientially, that's often how it goes. So here comes perception. Didn't take very long to go through the Rolodex and snoring. You know, previous experience with snoring, recognizing snoring. Unpleasant. Unpleasant. And volitional formations. Big basket, remember? There is this cascade, right? Ugh. Not again. I'm tired. Oh my God, I'm never going to get sleep. We have to wake up at 5:30. Maybe I should go sleep across the hall. I know somebody had to leave the retreat early. That door was open. That bed was made. Ooh, but the door was closed when I came in. Is that bed still available? That would be really embarrassing to walk in on somebody if they move somebody new into that room. I wonder if I should talk to the managers tomorrow. Oh, but I really like our room. I get to watch Turkey TV from our room. You know, I don't want to hurt her feelings. I mean, like, this did not take very long. This was a matter of moments, right? And so here's the spinning. Sometimes some of you may have heard that word papancha. It's this word in Pali that means mental proliferation. You know, it's just like this upwelling, unfolding. It's amazing what the mind can produce. So this quality of proliferation, right? So here we are. And consciousness, you know, it was there at the beginning with the moment of contact. And it's there all the way through. You know, it's just watching the whole circus unfold. And with the aggregates, there's often this momentum. You know, they fuel. It sort of fuels the cycle of suffering. Because here's this cascade of thoughts, and that fed right back into feeling tone, really unpleasant, you know? And then there was like more of a solid sense of form, like, ooh, there's tension in the body now because I'm kind of like worried I'm not gonna sleep. So form's getting more solid and more real as the snoring goes on. And, you know, there's more thoughts, you know? Okay, maybe, you know, and it's like, okay, the earplug's going, oh, I can still hear her, you know? It's like, and so it's like, here it is. And so there's this momentum and this challenge and this suffering. And then, you know, it's complicated because there were actually moments of neutral because there was like a pause between the snores. And then the thoughts changed a little bit because it was like, oh, maybe she rolled over. Maybe she'll stop long enough that I can get to sleep, you know. And then it would start over again because it's like, oh, here it comes again. So, you know, can you see the tangle and the arising? And so, you know, here's these ingredients coming together, and all of a sudden there's a self. There is a self to take care of, to protect, to defend. You know, it's like, I am the one who is being disturbed. I am the one who is irritated. And all of a sudden there's an other, she. Is the one who is snoring. She is the one who is disturbing my silence. You know? So, you know, this is where, and because I was somewhat settled, you know, even though all of this was going on, I was watching it and it was like, wow, wow. Look at the energy that's here in this entanglement. You know, I could really feel the discomfort. And so, you know, when there is selfing, when a self arises, when there's a sense of solidity, like I am here, we are always othering, you know, selfing and othering. You know, and this is really creating the great divide between humans, often with far greater consequence than a snoring roommate. Yeah. Although I recognize, for those of you who live with a snoring roommate, too many nights of disturbed sleep might lead to moments of homicidal impulses, or, you know, because it's hard, but really, you know, this is there's something really potent about a moment of seeing. And in seeing this, there was also a sense of seeing through this experience, like seeing that it was actually being constructed with all these ingredients. There was an experience that was there. There was a sound that was met, but it was actually met and filtered through all of, you know, the movements of heart and mind, the feeling, the perception, the thoughts. And I also had this awareness that, oh, this is actually not a solid experience that's out there. This is actually something like right in here that's happening. And I had this clarity, enough clarity of mind, that what came up was, you know, if I had walked in the door and then I was met with a sound of about the same volume and the same tone or resonance, but the mind had perceived it differently, this would be a totally different experience. Like, what if I had walked in this room and what had been perceived was frogs singing, or crickets chirping, or owls hooting, or coyotes howling? The Vedana would have been really different. I probably would have been like, pleasant. And the cascade of thoughts would have been really different. Like, how magical. Oh my gosh, I am so lucky to be sleeping in this beautiful place. I am getting serenaded to sleep. This is a gift. You know, can you see the construction, the conditionality of this experience? And it was so cool because, like, in that moment of recognizing, it was like, ooh, the self sort of dissolved. It just fell away. And the other dissolved and fell away. And I fell asleep. And I woke up refreshed the next morning. And it was okay. So, you know, these aggregates offer us an inroad to loosen our grip on experience. You know, and it's often hard to catch them all. But you know what I find is, like, if I can catch one, it's harder to catch them all. Like, you know, in daily life, we don't go, oh, look, I can just see forms arising and, you know, but we often can catch one. Vedana, you know, I can often see pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral in a moment. Or I can really see, like, there's a lot of proliferation. There's a lot of thoughts going on. And sometimes if I can see one, having and knowing about this roadmap of the aggregates, sometimes I can pause and actually fill in the others or a couple of them, and I can see that, I can start to see that these are building blocks, that if I pull one of them out, the wall might fall down, you know? So I, you know, that's one way to play with it, even in daily life. And I want to pause here and actually share with you another practice that was really helpful in that experience, and to actually introduce you to it and guide you through it briefly. And it's a practice that I've played with both on retreat and in daily life. And I heard about it from Susie Harrington, and it really helps to start to shine a light on how we often construct and inhabit these very partial views of self and other. And it's a practice called Not Only That. Not Only That. So if you're willing to play with me for a few minutes, I'd like to guide you through an introduction to this, and then we're going to return to this example and apply it here. So maybe just finding a way of sitting that's easeful. If you wish, closing the eyes, taking a breath or two. Feeling the body, maybe having some sense of this experience of form, through sensations or hearing. Maybe there's a taste of feeling tone. Maybe there's a sense of pleasant or unpleasant or neutral in this moment. There might be an awareness of volitional formations, the activity of the mind, thoughts or emotions. And for this practice, I'll be offering this repeating question to you, the question of who are you or what are you? And I'll use both at intervals because sometimes one or other, the other version of this question resonates more fully. And in response to this question, I invite you to just see what arises, you know, in the moment. You know, who are you? And what arises might be something related to one of the aggregates. It might be a sense of the body in some way. Oh, yeah, I'm an achy back, or hearing, this experience of hearing. Maybe it's an awareness of a thought, the thought of, I wonder what I have at home to snack on after meditation tonight, or, ah, I forgot to mail grandma's package. Or maybe there's an awareness when I ask, who are you? That's just a sense of, oh, I'm a moment or felt sense of pleasant or unpleasant. Or maybe what arises is one of the many roles or identities that you have in the world, a sense of, oh, I'm a mother, a partner, a daughter, a friend. You know, I'm a scientist, I'm a therapist, I'm a skier. So there's no supposed to's in this. So I'll offer you this question, who are you? See what arises. And then receiving this response, not only that. Who are you? Not only that. Who or what are you? Not only that. What are you? Not only that. What are you? not only that, just noticing, you know, what it was like to be invited to experience layer after layer after layer, perhaps, of what or who, you know, is included, all the different variations, versions, ingredients. And if we come back to this example of the snoring roommate, you know, one of the other practices that was really helpful that week was this one. Oh, not only that. And my roommate that week actually was someone, really dear friend. And I roomed for probably like 12 years with her. And I knew she was getting over a cold and, you know, never heard her snore like that before. And you know, even in everyday mind, I could see framing her and hanging her on the wall as the one who snores was incredibly incomplete, you know. And even if I hadn't been friends with her for 12 years, you know, just this little phrase of not only that, it's like, oh, you know, all these other things arose. Oh, like Dharma sister, friend. Wise counsel, mother, the one who loves cookies, the one who loves to walk barefoot, you know, the one who, you know, has left the nightlight on for me. You know, she's snoring, but she like tried to create this welcoming environment. You know, it just kept widening the view. And I could apply the same thing to the self. You know, it's like, oh, you know, the one who's irritated. Well, not only that. You know, the one who's grumpy. Oh, not only that. You know, oh, you know, the one who really appreciates this long friendship. Oh, yeah, not only that. Oh, the one who is learning something magnificent about the aggregates right now. Oh, not only that. You know, there's all these, it's this opening, you know, this softening. And it was really fun because we talked about it a little bit at the end of that retreat. And she was totally aware she was snoring. She's like, oh, I kept trying to wake myself up because I didn't want to, like, wake you up. And then, you know, in a moment of great humility, I got to learn that on that particular retreat, I was also the one who snored. And it was like, oh, wow, you know? So it's like, not only that. So, you know, we never know. So this partiality. And so, you know, this solidifying of self is really exhausting, you know, to have a self to tend to defend. It's a lot of work. I was on my most recent retreat, I sat two retreats back to back, and there's this incredible, I often think about it as the third retreat that's sandwiched right between. It's like that juncture where the retreats carry over, and it's like this unique experience because, you know, I had this sense of, ooh, I've been meditating for 10 days, and here's this whole fresh group of yogis coming in. And my the experience in the nervous system was like, the image that kept coming up in the mind was this herd of baby elephants. That's what they felt like, stomping around on the land, and which I found quite quite comical because yogis are not particularly loud humans in the scope of things, but the and to be surrounded by just fresh teachers, you know, the one who is, the one behind me sneezing on me, the one next to me, like, clacking their mala beads for the first several days of the retreat, the one who fidgeting, the one, and it was like all these noisy yogis invading my silence. Again, here's this territory to defend. And these moments of contact, like sneeze, here's form again, hearing, and then, this bracing, unpleasant, the thought of like, ooh, I don't want a cold, and all of a sudden I'm like protecting the self. And part of what happens when the self arises and the other arises is often the heart sort of closes. Quite, sometimes just a little bit and sometimes quite significantly. And that's painful too. And so there was this, this opening and closing of the heart and this arising and dissolving of the self in this juncture between retreats and this moment of like, one of the practices I played with too was this like, drop it, just drop the self, don't pick it up, It's sort of like the mind picks up this sense of self, like a puppy picks up a slipper and just gnaws on it. It's like, oh, mind. And it's like, and then just dropping the self. And the heart would open. Here's this person sniffling behind me, and there would be this moment of like, oh, may you be free from suffering. May you know comfort and ease and health. And so it's, this is really powerful practice. And when I think about it, and part of what I love about this practice of the Dharma, this incredible map that we're offered, and we're looking at a little corner of it tonight, of the aggregates, this map that offers the possibility for freedom, like right here and now, it's available in like this human life, in the midst of the struggle and the suffering, big or small. And, I look at this world and there is so much suffering right now. We're in the midst of environmental and social crises. And, when I think about that and I think about the snoring roommate, it's like, well, what does the snoring roommate have to teach us about, the suffering that's almost on this unfathomable scale right now? And what happened in the heart and mind with the snoring roommate, this is what happens in the heart and mind in these moments that are much bigger. This patterning in the heart of selfing and othering and creating this divide and this territory, where wars are fought, where borders are protected, where tremendous amounts of resources are consumed. And so the snoring roommate is actually this accessible example, I think, of where we can step back and look at this, look at the aggregates on a scale that we could perhaps see clearly and learn something and not be so overwhelmed that we're completely shut down. And so the learning happens in these small moments. And, these moments of insight allow for the beginnings of transformation, of the habits. Our practice is called Vipassana, right? Vipassana is insight meditation. We're meant to examine and understand the habits of the mind and the heart. It's not just about achieving some peaceful, blissed out place. That's a really great place to visit. But we live in the world. And we are met by this just river of contact all the time. And so, you know, working with this sense of selfing and othering is really potent. And so I want to sort of summarize some of these ways of working with self that we've talked about and bring in a couple more. So one is, you know, we can just notice selfing. You know, sometimes just labeling, like, oh, selfing, there's a lot of self in the room right now, can be a way of softening and taking the self less seriously. If it speaks to you, you can become more aware of the aggregates, that, oh, actually the self is not so solid. It's this five kinds of stuff, comes together, falls apart, and it's influenced. It's like these filters. And if you can catch one aggregate, you know, maybe you can play with filling in some of the others. I think it can be particularly helpful to get familiar with volitional formations, you know. Have some label. It could just be thinking. Could be proliferating. My favorite one of late is fabricating. It really lets me know I'm telling a story. Oh, fabricating. Fabricating. I'm telling a story about me, and I'm telling a story about you. And so another is this drop it practice. If it speaks to you, you know, sometimes I just watch this puppy mind gnawing on a sense of self or on a moment. And it's like, drop it, drop it, drop it, you know. It just keeps picking it up. But it's a way to have a sense of humor about the habit and how strong it is. If it speaks to you, not only that is I am finding a really helpful. You know, when I'm coming face to face with you know, a really small sense of my own self, to sort of be like, oh, okay, not only that, not only that. Or when I'm in a tight place with someone else and I'm frustrated and I'm othering and I really, you know, it's like, oh, not only that. To see the fuller humanity of self and other. To remember that we're living in that wizard photo, right? Not the muggle photo. Things are changing. They're moving. An extension of drop it that I also like to play with is dropping thoughts mid-sentence. You know, like if you start a thought, it's okay that you began it, but like you don't actually have to complete it. So sometimes just like I say that to a thought, it's like, ooh, drop it. You know, like I really literally put it down. I'm like, I know this. This is a bad rerun. I'm not watching this one again, you know. So, and then finally, kindness practice, metta. We often don't think of metta or kindness as a practice of not self or of anatta, but it is. That could be a whole talk in and of itself. But, you know, this practice, I love the Metta Sutta. And when we recite that, you know, this opening of the heart to all beings, you know, whatever living beings there may be, whether weak or strong, omitting none, it's really inclusive, you know. The great or the mighty, you know, short or, you know, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, you know, those living near and far away, those born and to be born. So when the heart is more open, there is less self in the room. You might even just start to notice that. So if the heart practices speak to you, that's a pathway to softening the self. And then when there's less self in the room, conversely, you know, the heart is more open. So I'll just close with a few lines from the Samyutta Nikaya. And this is a translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. And he says, bhikkhus, so we can just insert ourselves here, so those who practice. Whatever is not yours, abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness. And what is it, bhikkhus, that is not yours? Form is not yours. Abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness. Feeling is not yours. Abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness. Perception is not yours. Volitional formations are not yours. Consciousness is not yours. Abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness. You know, so this practice of abandoning the aggregates, of putting the self down, lightens the load. You know, we can take the self less seriously. And in turn, open the heart more fully to the world and to each other, to this moment. So let's just sit for just a few moments. Appreciating the goodness, the integrity and of gathering together to practice, to open hearts and minds to a deeper understanding. The patterning that can lead to so much suffering. May all beings have clarity of mind. May all beings have a generosity of heart. May all beings be free from suffering.